You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Coming up, Wisconsin waterways include hundreds of dams, and the state is pushing for more of them to be replaced. We hear how cities and towns are working with regulators to keep their dams safe.
First, Governor Walker declared a state of emergency this week for three northwestern counties after a tornado killed one person and injured many on Tuesday. We'll get the details of this and other top stories in our weekly review of state news.
Robert Mentzer joins us now. He's a storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thank you.
So bring us up to speed with the tornado situation that hit on Tuesday. What do we know?
So this tornado hit Mobile Home Park in Prairie Lake in Barron County, north of Eau Claire, and just laid waste to the mobile homes there. Killed a 45-year-old man named Eric Gavin, who was one of the residents, and injured 27 people. There were 58 trailer homes in the park, and 15 were completely destroyed. A number of others were damaged. According to a local TV station, the residents whose homes were not destroyed have been mostly, you know, have not moved back in, but maybe permitted to come home today.
There was also a turkey barn that was leveled, I understand.
Yes, yeah, and turkey processing plant was across the street, and yeah, I saw a report saying that there were turkeys wandering around in the debris, and people lost their animals as well. That's another part of the story, is that, you know, the local Humane Society has been responding as well, because there are a number of pets and animals that were missing after the storm.
And our news reporter, Rich Kramer, he was out there covering the aftermath, and we have a clip of Barron County Sheriff Chris Fitzgerald. Let's take a listen.
You can just see where the path went through. It's amazing that we're not talking about multiple dead people. And it's just, and the trailers show it, so it's amazing. It's a miracle.
So this trailer park area got the bulk of the damage, is that right?
Right, certainly the worst of the damage. The tornado itself, it takes time to reconstruct these things, but the meteorologists are saying that it touched down for between 30 and 60 miles, which is very unusual, which is the National Weather Service says is 10 times longer than is typical for this sort of storm. So this, you know, in that path, this is a relatively sparsely populated area that the tornado went through, but it hit directly on this in this trailer park area, and that's where the worst of the damage was for residences.
And do we know how long it'll take to clean up, or what assistance these residents will receive to get their lives back together?
Sure. Well, it's a long process for sure. The Red Cross is providing supplies to residents. There have been emergency shelters open. And the governor has declared a state of emergency. So one thing that state of emergency triggers is the option for residents to apply for financial assistance, given the disruption in their lives. And, the fact that many of the victims here are in lower socioeconomic status, it's a fair bet that is going to be needed. There have been a bunch of GoFundMe sites that have cropped up, or, GoFundMe
mm-hmm.
accounts.
Yeah.
The sheriff advises against that at the moment. They're not sort of official, although people can give what they want. But I think that, the Red Cross is sort of the clearinghouse there.
We're talking right now with Rob Mentzer. He's a storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, looking at the big stories rounding out Wisconsin news this week. And moving on now to Milwaukee County Sheriff David Clark, who made a big announcement this week. The four-term sheriff is leaving his post. Rob, what do we know about this?
Yeah, Clark has been angling hard for a position in the Trump administration, and this week it happened for him, maybe. On Wednesday, he told a conservative radio show that he would be taking a position with the U.S. Department of Homeland Security's Office of Partnership and Engagement, that he'd be a liaison there to state and local law enforcement. And there was a little bit of a weird back and forth because then the Homeland Security Department itself issued a statement saying that no such announcement has been made. But it seems like they're referring to the announcement rather than the actual position. So most likely he's going to join the Trump administration.
And there was also a little back and forth with Governor Walker's office. He's saying he's resigned, and yet we heard that from Governor Walker's spokesperson that they hadn't received his resignation letter.
Yeah, you know, one starts to get the sense that Clark is not a real detail-oriented guy. I don't know. It's a bit, I think it seems pretty clear that he got out ahead of himself saying this on the radio. It's just sort of been transparently his main goal for a period of many months. He was in Trump Tower during the sort of Trump transition team time in December, January, and at that time some people were saying he was a possible candidate for director of Homeland Security. He must have just been really excited to hold in the news.
He's also been a very provocative political figure and polarizing for that matter. Can you kind of give us a portrait of his four terms in office?
He's hard right, extreme conservative, and his bread and butter is he's the guy who will make the outrageous statements and go further than any other sort of conservative commentator, let alone office holding sheriff. He's called for the suspension of habeas corpus in order to round up hundreds of thousands of people he accuses of terrorism. He wants to hold them in Guantanamo Bay. That's his idea. He makes no distinction about whether they should be American citizens, and he regularly refers to Black Lives Matter as a terrorist organization. In his jail, the jail he oversees has had four deaths, including the dehydration death of an inmate whose water was turned off for 7 days. That's the case that a jury just recently recommended criminal charges against seven jail staff members. And he's called for the use of tear gas to disband peaceful protests. So this is sort of his game, to make out their statements, and that may have appealed to the Trump administration.
You also shared a thread on your Twitter feed from a veteran who is feeling frustrated with the sheriff's uniform. Can you tell us a little bit about what this thread was about?
Yeah, so I found this really interesting, and it's in a way it seems a bit trivial, but I think it is truly revealing. A U.S. Army veteran who's a liberal online commentator named Charles Clymer had a series of tweets pointing out that Clark pins medals across the front of his uniform, but he does it in a way that has nothing to do with any uniform code or does not signify what Clark has actually done. You look at the photo of him when he spoke at the Republican National Convention, and he has medals and ribbons all over his uniform, and it signals a kind of martial authority, and it's just made up. Clymer wrote this in his small sort of Twitter essay, wrote, "Military and police decorations are earned. They take hard work and sacrifice. Colin Powell once described a dress uniform as a soldier's resume." But in Clark's case, he's wearing, badge replicas and flag pins. People were pointing out that a couple of the pins that he wears are literally sold at Walmart. So I think this actually gets to something real. There's a desire to signal a sort of militaristic or quasi-military credentials, and it's about an inch deep.
Well, finally, as we wrap up here, the UW-Madison Twitter feed was hacked this week. Can you tell us what happened there?
Yeah, so it could have been worse, but UW-Madison got hacked. There was the tweet, LOL, why go to university when you can just sit at home and fail at life and stuff, which if I do a close reading, I think is actually an argument for going to college, but anyway... You know, so it could have been worse. So the Twitter feed was hacked. Some goof posted a handful of tweets like these, but there was no indication of any hacking of a computer system. There wasn't a breach of student data, not even any, like, malware links posted on the account. So it's kind of, like, mildly embarrassing to the university, but looks like it was, well, let's put it this way, it looks like it was not North Korea here.
Well, and people are very nervous about hacking right now. They're on edge. What did UW officials say about the hack?
Yeah, I mean, they said it's a reminder to have two-factor identification and to monitor how social media feeds are administered, and maybe they do. I let it be said, as somebody who administers a handful of Twitter accounts as part of my job sometimes, there but for the grace of God go any of us. I do think it is the case that hacking is to some extent a fact of life today, and so there's sort of, you know, actual malicious hacking that can do real damage and harm, and then there's this, which appears, on as far as we can tell, appears to have just been someone sort of goofing off.
Rob, thanks so much for joining us.
All right, thank you.
Rob Mentzer is storytelling editor for the USA Today Network, Wisconsin, based in Wausau. He joins us every Friday to look back at the week's biggest news.
This is Central Time. Anyone who's had to sort through the laundry to try to match socks knows it can be an infuriating task.
Or maybe not so infuriating if you can figure out a systematic way of matching sizes and colors in the heap before you.
Our guest is a data visualizer, and he says this is a prime example of algorithmic thinking, and we do it every day. If we didn't, we wouldn't be able to pair up those socks.
Ellie Al-Mosawi's latest book is Bad Choices, How Algorithms Can Help You Think Smarter and Live Happier. Ellie, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
Your new book, it's called Bad Choices. What are these bad choices we make that get us into trouble and make our lives sometimes a little complicated or miserable?
Yeah, absolutely. The title comes from one of the ways that algorithms are described in literature in terms of goodness and badness with respect to efficiency. So when I was thinking about the question of how to make algorithms compelling to the broadest audience, I realize that there are things we do in everyday life that kind of fit the definition of an algorithm. And therefore, we can use some of the tools that computer scientists use to evaluate if two algorithms are good or if one is better than the other, and use that tool, for instance, to do the same to evaluate everyday decisions that we make.
And how would you explain what an algorithm is?
An algorithm is typically defined as a series of unambiguous steps. It has a beginning, it has an end, and it does something useful. So if you think about websites and apps that we have nowadays, there are a ton of algorithms behind the scenes encapsulating all the logic that you see as features on a website, for instance. And, they have to be unambiguous because computers, they don't have the ability fundamentally to reason about things. They have to, they simply process instructions. So if we want something like predictability from them and efficiency ultimately, then we have to be clear with those steps.
And you reference a computer scientist who spoke of good algorithms, which helped lead you to the title of your book. How can we judge whether a particular algorithm is good or whether it's bad?
Yeah, it has to do with what quality we care about. So in this case, and throughout the book, you'll notice that the quality that's top of mind and highlighted all the time is efficiency. So when we talk about good approaches and bad approaches, we mean with respect to efficiency.
So let's step through one of these approaches with one of the examples in your book, and that one is navigating the grocery store. And I spend a lot of time on this particular algorithm because it pertains a lot to my life and anyone else who goes to the grocery store. But walk me through this algorithm.
Sure. So the nice thing about that and other chapters is that there is no claim that one way is better than all other ways. There's a kind of a discussion of the relative benefits of each. So in the case of being in a grocery store, you have these aisles that you have to traverse, and it's a problem that you see in computing as well. How do you traverse a graph of things? So if you look at a grocery store as a graph, how would you go from one point to another if you care about efficiency? And you know, the key there is a theme that we see in other chapters as well. It's trying to use something like memory, which is to say avoiding repetition, avoiding walking along, you know, the same aisles over and over again. And that's how you partially how you achieve efficiency. Another component to it is how you organize your shopping list. Like you organize it in terms of proximity to the entrance, and you categorize them in terms of kind of the categories that you find in the grocery store, and so on. So that's kind of the theme and the insight that you get from each of the chapters. It's a discussion of kind of the connection to computer science from everyday life, and also the alternative ways that you could go about doing something, and how do those ways compare.
But in that example, you could waste a lot of time. I think it was 40 minutes by using the algorithm that wasn't as efficient.
Absolutely, because of repetition. And, you know, that memory, you know, there's another chapter, the very first chapter, in fact, where you see the effect of, you know, of using memory in a good way. So with the sock example that you mentioned at the outset of the segment, in that case, there are these two methods that we could use to go through a pile of socks. And simply by kind of adjusting the way we do that, we can turn the we can make the approach much more efficient, from a quadratic time approach to a linear time approach, which if you graph them you know, as two separate lines, you see how they compare.
it makes the laundry pile and those socks I mean, do you think in different ways when you go around your house, Ali? I mean, really, what goes through your brain?
Yeah, it's interesting because when I started this project, I wasn't thinking in terms of, you know, what do I do in my life and could I model those as algorithms? I started from the other end. I thought, these are the fundamental algorithms that exist in computing. Is there a way to map them to everyday life? And it's only when I did that that I was able to kind of think about these things that I do every day, these mundane things, in terms of algorithms.
We're talking right now with Ali Al-Moussaoui. His new book is Bad Choices, How Algorithms Can Help You Think Smarter and Live Happier. Ali, there's a point in your book where you say algorithms are artistic, they're graceful, they have elegance. What are you talking about? How are algorithms artful?
Yeah, that comes partially from a segment I watched a long time ago, back when I was in high school, I think, maybe 15 years ago or so. A BBC reporter asks Richard Feynman the same question. He says, I forget what the question was, but the answer was, or the topic was, you know, is science as beautiful as a piece of art, you know, a drawing or a painting or a flower that someone might see and appreciate? And the answer he gave was, you know, was great. He said, you see the same kind of elegance everywhere in the world. It doesn't have to be, you know, it could be manifest in equations, or it could be manifest, in this case, in an algorithm, right? The way it's structured, the way the logic kind of ties together, the efficiency of it. There are all these factors that contribute to beauty, and I think that's what I was referring to.
And you use illustrations heavily in your book to illustrate the points of these algorithms, and they're really clever. Why did you decide to do that?
Yeah, the illustrations, they're by my collaborator Alejandro Geraldo, and he's very talented. We've been working together for 4 years now, and you're right. Illustrations are, when I think about a project, I don't think of it in terms of the implementation. Right? I don't say this is something that I want to implement in code or in writing or in something else. I think of what's the best way to present this, and usually it's a combination of things. So it so happens that in this project and in the previous one, Bad Arguments, marrying text with illustrations was the best way to produce something that's compelling and useful. And so I remember, even when I sent the manuscript to the publisher, it had my own sketches of the various illustrations, because I feel they're essential to the message I'm trying to convey.
Let's take a call now. Becky in Beloit. Hi, Becky.
Hey, you know, I work at a library, and we're trying to go through a one service model thing, which it wasn't my original call, but, you know, great segue. Anyhow, I went to the grocery store today, and when I make a list, I make it because I want to get through fast. So I make a list on how I'm going to start and go from there, and I go around the outside walls and then up and down the aisles. I never hit anywhere twice. You know, making a list is great for memory because then you don't have to look at it very often because you've kind of already memorized it. So I just thought that was a great idea. And, you know, the way you navigate, you know, the spaghetti diagrams and stuff like that is really, it's a great topic. So thank you.
Ali, what about going on the outer edges and what about the path she takes?
Yeah, that's great. I mean, if it works for you, if it's efficient, if you don't, you know, if there is minimal repetition, then that's one way of achieving efficiency. And I ought to say that there are, you know, if you read about this topic in the literature, you'll find that there are sophisticated techniques for traversing graphs, you know, that are bigger than a grocery store.
You point out that speed is not always a virtue. In which cases would being slow be a plus?
Yeah, one area is learning, for instance. Another is if you want to be creative or if you just want to soak something in. You don't really care about finishing it or maximizing or optimizing for efficiency. You know, usually when we talk about efficiency, it's because we want to do something in the shortest amount of time or take up the smallest amount of space. But if we don't care about that quality, then often it might be the case that slowness is a virtue. And learning is a perfect example. I know in my case, at least, sometimes it takes me a long time to understand something, and I've seen that over and over again in the books that I read and in people I talk to. So that's one case where a teacher who tries to look for fast learners and then ignore the rest, I think they're missing something important.
Ali Al-Mousawi is the author of Bad Choices, How Algorithms Can Help You Think Smarter and Live Happier. When the Oroville Dam in California suffered damage earlier this year, more than 180,000 people living downstream from it were evacuated. While Wisconsin hasn't had to take similar action, we do have hundreds of dams that require regular upkeep. In the last decade, the state has stepped up its monitoring of dams and required more municipalities to build replacements, but that can be expensive, especially for small towns.
Eric Litke joins us now. He's an investigative reporter for USA Today Network Wisconsin and a contributor for PolitiFact Wisconsin. He's been reporting on dams here in the state. Eric, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you write that big storms that went through in 2008 in Wisconsin resulted in the draining of Lake Delta and also marked a turning point for the DNR's oversight of dams. What changed as a result?
It just really became more of an emphasis point for the agency, basically to make sure they had the plans in place and we're being more aggressive about really the dam structure that existed as well. So it became kind of a couple different thrusts. One core element was the revival of a state grant program that allowed some matching funds for especially the smaller municipalities to be able to rebuild aging dams that had issues revealed and the DNR felt like there was some safety issues that needed to be addressed. Those are pretty big budget projects, and typically something the local municipalities can't afford without some kind of state help. So this really opened the door to allow that to happen. And then on the oversight side, it also became a point of emphasis for the DNR to really be hammering home the need for an emergency action plan. This is typically a document that dozens of pages and outlines points of contact and what exactly needs to be done in a different type of emergency that a dam could face, so that is something that's really set out ahead of time and is submitted to the DNR and to other local authorities, so when something like that arises, they have that in place. And so there's still a number of dams that don't have this really completed yet, but that number has shrunk significantly with that being a point of emphasis over the last decade.
And you mentioned the renewal of this grant program that can help pay for the repairs or the replacement, or even sometimes it sounds like the removal of a dam. And this can be a costly enterprise. How much does it cost in some instances to work on a dam and make upgrades?
Typically, the DNR is asking for dams to simply be torn out and rebuilt. A lot of these have kind of been a dam built on top of a dam on top of a dam. In Hortonville and Outagamie County, for example, they tore out the kind of piecemeal dam that was there, and underneath that found the remnants of two prior wooden dams that dated back to the 1800s. So really, to do it right, the DNR is pushing that you tear all this out and you build something entirely new. So, I mean, that can be anywhere from, you know, $500,000 for a smaller dam to several million for even a moderately sized lake. So, like, for example, one of the villages we looked at was Ogdensburg in Waupaca County. They've got, you know, 200 people that live there, an annual budget of $70,000. So any kind of six-digit project like that is really not going to be manageable.
Yeah, let's talk about that Ogdensburg Dam. That's an interesting one. It was classified as a high-hazard dam, which is part of the issue there. Tell us about what being a high-hazard dam means.
Well, high-hazard dam means that in the DNR's calculations, there is a loss of life is probable in a major rain event. So for that type of, during a dam failure, the loss of life would be probable. So there's kind of a threshold there where they need to then have a dam that is able to survive a 1,000-year storm, which is basically a storm that has a 0.1% chance of happening in any given year. And that's really where a lot of the contentiousness of the dam program comes in, is a dam that can withstand a 1,000-year storm is going to be pretty large for a given site. And in a lot of cases, the local officials really view it as overkill. So there's always going to be some back and forth and some discontent over the size and the price tag associated with that, which is certainly what Ogdensburg had. They get to the end of it, and ultimately they're glad to have this dam rebuilt. They had that finished up late last year. So they kind of look back and say, you know, it's good that we did this, but did it have to be this large?
And another thing that can happen besides replacing the dam, putting in a new one, sometimes houses can be moved, too. How is that taking shape?
Sure. Well, part of the requirement is for these high-hazard dams, they have to be rebuilt to a given level. And in some cases, that can create some significant price tags. In Vernon County, there is a dam at Rung Hollow that would have required about $20 million to rebuild. So the county instead looked at what was it that was causing this high hazard status. And it's not that there was a large development below the dam, but there was just kind of a scattering of about 10 houses kind of in the drainage area below that would have been affected. So for them, they used some federal grant funds and other monies to purchase and relocate those houses. They ended up spending about $1 million to relocate the houses. With those gone, it was no longer a high-hazard dam, it was low-hazard. That allowed them to do a very different type of rebuild on it and repairs on it that came in about $4 million instead of $20 million.
We're talking with Eric Littke right now, investigative reporter for USA Today Network Wisconsin, and we're talking about the state of Wisconsin's dams and a push by the DNR for more repairs and more replacements. And, Eric, how often are Wisconsin's dams inspected, and what do we know so far about what kind of condition they're in overall?
The inspections vary by the hazard status. The owners are required to check on them a couple times a year. The DNR itself, like for high-hazard dams, for example, they're coming in every 10 years. But there's also some requirements to have outside engineers come in and look. So it's really kind of all across the board, but on some kind of annual, semi-annual basis, someone with some knowledge base there is supposed to be coming in and taking a look. Part of the trick with all of this is the jurisdictional issues of who exactly has oversight. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission oversees dams generally that are used in power generation. So out of the about 200 high-hazard dams in the state, they oversee about 50 of them. DNR has about 150. But there's some overlap there in that there's always some confusion about, you know, what exactly is a dam, or is this part of this dam or a second dam. So the result is you've got two different government agencies, one state, one federal, that have two different sets of rules for what exactly they're supposed to be prepared for, what an emergency action plan looks like, how often they're supposed to be inspected. So it leads to some miscommunication and ultimately, the issue that there is not really one central place that you can go to and say, okay, how many dams in the state have this level of condition? How many have this emergency action plan? So there are some attempts to merge the data that those two agencies have, but from reviewing that, there's some inaccuracies, there's some lack of updating that happens. So they're typically kind of dependent on the DNR needs to kind of watch their side of the world, and the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission needs to watch their dams, and they kind of just hope that nothing is getting missed between them.
And you said that these emergency plans that are now being required, they don't all exist yet. Are there resources available for towns, municipalities to go and get some help in putting these plans together?
They will typically hire a consultant of some kind who has some experience putting those together. The onus is really on the municipality to go and get that done, though.
And you mentioned earlier that an owner would have to come as part of this assessment process, which involves different parties, to inspect the dam, too. Who are typically the owners of Wisconsin's dams?
That's really all across the board. There's a number that are, especially on the power generating side, that are owned by We Energies or other smaller power companies, utility companies. There's a lot of municipalities that own their own dams. You think particularly of villages where, you know, they were kind of built around this historically, going back 100 to 150 years, that there was a mill and they created the mill pond and they built the dam. And so in a lot of cases, the municipalities have taken over ownership there. And then once you start getting to more the low hazard and significant hazard dams, it's a lot of them that are just on private property. And one of the things the DNR has run into is that there's some ownership disagreement on who exactly owns this dam, because dams tend to be more of a liability than an asset. And so there's one high hazard dam, for example, that they've been fighting to get an emergency action plan on for years, but no one's been willing to step forward and say, this is our dam, between private owners and the municipality. And so ultimately they're just going to go in and get a state grant to remove that.
Now, going back to kind of where we started, the dam in Ogdensburg, which was redone, replaced, and then rebuilt, it sounds as though the population of Ogdensburg took a hit, too. So are we seeing that there are impacts of these dams on communities that go far beyond just the cost of putting in a dam?
And that's a big part of why the state dam grant has had an impact and has been well received, is that, yeah, the dams are holding back some pretty important local waterways. In Hortonville, we see that's the only public access recreational lake in Outagamie County. So for them, it's not really an option. You need to keep that around as a public resource. And in Ogdensburg, we saw something similar, that this whole village, 200 people as it was really built around the fact that there was this lake here. And so when the lake was drained around 2011 to try to kill weeds, they discovered at that point there's this problem with the dam. It needs to be either repaired or removed to get rid of the lake. And they saw their population drop and those lakefront homes go up for sale without having that community asset. So for them, they went through this 5-6 year period of not having the lake as part of that community, and that's been a big thing for them to be able to come back now and get the lake back up to the level last year. And they said those lakefront homes immediately sold, and they see their small population going back to where it was.
Eric, thanks a lot for talking today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Eric Littke, investigative reporter for USA Today Network Wisconsin, joining us to talk about the safety of the state's dams.
This is Central Time. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. The Social Security Administration just released a comprehensive look at baby names in the United States in 2016. The data goes deep and can be sorted by state, region, or change in popularity.
As far as Wisconsin goes, here we go. The top two baby names in 2016 are Oliver and Olivia.
Veronica, do you have a child named Oliver or Olivia, perhaps?
I do not. And certainly not at the same time. That's too many O names for one family. I shouldn't say that. There could be families with lots and lots of O names, but not in our family. But I do know that there are certain unnamed folks at WPR who do have children with one of these names. So I guess that's some evidence for the popularity. Mm-hmm. And nationally speaking, the top two names are not Oliver and Olivia. They are instead Noah and Emma.
And picking a baby name, it's tough business. It has to be fresh, maybe unique, but not too unique. And then how do you spell it? And how much does your name affect your life anyway? So call us and tell us how you picked your baby's name and whether or not you like your own name at 800-642-1234.
But we both want to have babies while it's still cool. I already have all the names picked out. If it's a girl, Bookcase, or Sandstorm, or maybe Hat, but that's more of a boy's name.
Yeah, I was going to say.
That was a clip from the show 30 Rock, where a young character named Ceri explains to Tina Fey's Liz Lemon that she's already chosen the names for her future children. We heard Hat and Bookcase. Those were not, by the way, on the list of the most popular names for 2016.
The most popular ones, Oliver, Olivia, we got Henry, we got Emma in the mix, we got Liam and Ava and Owen and Harper, we got Mason, Charlotte, the list goes on. But we want to hear from you, and let's first go to Maciej in Tomahawk. Hi, Maciej.
Good afternoon. How are you today?
Good. Did I pronounce that correctly, first of all?
Yeah, it's Maciej. Like I say, I was telling the gal who spoke with me initially, I came from overseas. I came from the Tatra Mountains. And my full name is Maciej Andrzej Terzjezi Roman Zygmunt Domingo Gorleski.
Wow, that is beautiful. And so that is your full name with your middle name as well?
Yeah, with my full name. Correct. So what happened here is, like I said, I came at a later stage. When I was in junior high school, I was told to use my first name. Okay, well, all the spaces in school, those little squares that they gave you to write your name out on, did not work out for me at all.
I can just guess what that must have been like.
Let alone the driver's license years later.
Right. Those legal forms, you know, initially when he came here, and it took us 17 months to get here legally, between the paperwork and the visas and everything else. Once we did arrive here, you know, to fill out the visas and the paperwork and everything else, and our whole family has long names like that. You know, it's one of those situations where what they did to people in Ellis Island, where they came from overseas, where are you going to New York? So suddenly you became Tony.
Right. Wow. Well, that's something people have to think about these days with the bubbles. I understand it is not fair for those of us with longer names. And even Veronica Rickert, by the way, Maciej, I remember feeling like it took forever to fill out all those. And I envied sort of the Chris Evans in my classes. Well, thank you so much for calling. And we'll go next to Nancy. Nancy joins us in Trempealeau. Nancy, hi.
Hello. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. I'm calling about my name. I have finally come to the conclusion that I have entered the era where I have an old lady's name, because nobody has named their child Nancy in at least a decade or two.
I think you're right. I think I don't think at least that Nancy was on the list of the top 100 girls' names or 50 girls' names in Wisconsin in 2016. But I don't know if that means it's an old lady's name. It means you have a classic name.
How do you feel about that?
Well, I think it's funny because as you do age, you want to, particularly in a professional setting, you don't want to be the old lady in the room. And when you have an old lady's name, it kind of points you out. And when I was growing up, Nancy was incredibly popular. I had like five or six other Nancys in my grade. And I still run into them, you know, Nancys that are out there, but nobody under the age of 35, maybe 40. So I think it's a disadvantage in a professional setting where youth is something that's coveted.
That's an interesting perspective, yeah. Nancy. You could start rebranding it as vintage and then it will be cool again. You could put a silent P in front of it. But I don't know if that's going to help.
Yeah.
But I think it's a lovely name. Thank you so much for calling in, Nancy. Appreciate it.
Let's now go to Janetta in Muskoda.
Hi.
Hi, Janetta.
Hi there. I just wanted to say, you know, with all these different names coming out about my grandchildren, kind of a new name, and people were kind of like, oh, my goodness, his name is Hannibal, and it's Hannibal Ganymede. And they just kind of liked it because Ganymede, the conqueror, rather than the Hannibal Lecter. But I'm really proud of that. And they named their daughter Una, and Una Antares, which is a bright star up there. So kind of a resurgence of some different names. But I'm very proud of my name. It's Johnetta. And my parents' name were John and Loretta. So they combined them together. And when I was younger, I kind of felt awkward about it. But now that I'm older, I really kind of appreciate that it's this sort of one of a kind because of the combination of my parents' name.
Yeah, well, that's really neat. And you know, what neat grandkid names. I mean, we just don't hear those names at all. How have they taken on to them?
Well, they're still pretty young right
okay.
now. Yeah, and so hopefully, you know, there won't be too much backlash for the Hannibal, but they call him Hanny, which is, you know, nice. But I think it's kind of a cool name.
Me too. I agree with that. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for that, Colin, for sharing those. Some nice unusual names there that are working well. And let's go to Linda in Madison next. Linda, hi.
Hi. For future reference, the previous caller is from a town called Muscaday.
Thank you so much, Linda.
I know you're new to Wisconsin, but now you know. For me, my daughter, her first name is... traditional Hebrew name with a Celtic Welsh prefix. It's pronounced Kindara, spelled C-Y-N-D-A-R-A. And her middle name, Louise, was a name that was used on both sides of the family. And it's a nice blend.
Ah, Kindara, that's pretty. I like that.
Yeah, and that one is unique as well. You were not seeing that in on the list here at all.
Yeah, definitely not on the list. Although there were a couple on the list that I hadn't heard of before. One was Brielle, I think. Have you heard of the name Brielle,
not.
Kate?
No.
Yep, me either, but lots of people have, apparently.
And it really also depends where in the country you are, because you can look at this, you can break it down by state, and you can see the waves of the different names.
Right, so interesting.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for all the calls today. We appreciate that. Wish we had more time. Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts about your names, your maybe misgivings about your names, or the love that you have for your name, your grandchildren's name. And don't forget... you can keep this conversation going and share your thoughts about names, good and bad, over on the Central Time Facebook page.